It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day a day early. Not really. Actually, politics the focus of our entire hour, but we will have politics as usual tomorrow, Wednesday. Later in this hour, Michelle Bernard will be with us, political analyst. She'll talk about how American women are changing politics. But first, my guest this first half hour is State Senator Matt McCoy. He served for over 20 years in the Iowa legislature. He has a long list of legislative achievements, but that's not why we've invited him on the program today. This hour, we want to have him share some of the experiences and views contained in his new book. It's titled, McCoy, You're Going Straight to Hell, Heartfelt Letters to a Gay State Senator on Marriage Equality, published by Virtual Bookworm, co-authored with Jim Ferguson. In it, he tells his personal story of coming out privately, also as a public official. He relays the stories and views of those impacted by laws preventing same-sex marriage, and also tells the stories of those who don't agree with the same-sex marriage. McCoy is Iowa's highest-ranking openly gay elected official. In fact, when he came out 11 years ago, he was the only openly gay person in our state capitol. Senator Matt McCoy, welcome to our program.
Ben, thanks for having me.
When we set up this interview, little did we know that controversy over the Indiana Religious Freedom Law would be all the buzz in national news, our lead story at the top of this hour. If I can, please let me start off by asking you, before we get to your book, how you see the national reaction to the law, the backlash, and the reaction of Indiana Governor Mike Pence.
Well, I think the governor was engaged in a massive miscalculation, and what actually passed and was signed into law in Indiana has been attempted to be introduced in Iowa, and ultimately we're talking about a bill that denies people equal access in employment, housing, and public accommodation based upon their sexual orientation or gender identity. And this is an outrageous step, and I think the half steps that the governor has indicated that he's willing to take to clarify his bad law will only further inflame and point out just how out of step this is with where the country is in terms of human rights for gay and lesbian and transgender people.
Let's talk about your book now. McCoy, You're Going Straight to Hell, Heartfelt Letters to a Gay State Senator on Marriage Equality. What was your goal in writing this book?
Well, it's very interesting because as Iowa became the third state in the nation to allow marriage equality for gays and lesbians, the focus of the country really turned to the Iowa legislature and urging legislators to either leave everything alone or to enact a constitutional amendment. And so we received literally thousands of emails from all over the country and a lot from Iowans with opinions that were as diverse as you can imagine with respect to either supporting or opposing marriage equality, some based upon religious convictions in support of marriage equality, some based on religious convictions opposing marriage equality. And so we started collecting them and categorizing them and putting them into binders, trying to understand what's going on here, what's happening. And we realized pretty quickly that this was really, these were political artifacts that talked about a civil rights movement that began with the Varnum Breen decision and was working its way across the country ultimately, and that would be beneficial for students that study civil rights movements. And so we decided to put them in a book.
Mm-hmm. And that is your book, McCoy, You're Going Straight to Hell. That is a reference to one of the pieces of feedback you get. Tell us the context in which that one was said. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just basically not only was I going straight to hell, but I was bringing the souls of innocent Iowans with me that I was responsible for all these souls that would be lost as a result of marriage equality. And, the interesting thing you learn as an elected official is that because of the anonymity of email, people will write just about anything and say just about anything. And I shared those comments in the book only to show people just what we're dealing with as elected officials and how we have to respond to constituents.
Mm-hmm. Now, the letters and emails that you received, some of them are filled with hope and joy about same-sex marriage in this debate. Some, as you pointed out, filled with hate or condemnation.
Right.
Some trying to convince you in various ways to change your mind. What struck me about this, too, is just very well-meaning people writing, and none of these, many of these, I don't want to say all of them, don't have the author written in the book, right?
Right. We protected everyone's identity.
Mm-hmm. Here's one that pops out at me. Comment on it if you'd like. I am happily married with 3 young children and am very upset about the court's ruling. I'm thinking about our state's future, what kind of people this will attract. I do not want to have to explain to my young children why 2 men or 2 women are kissing like that in public. It is outrageous to consider this as a tool to bring in more money for the state. Do you really want to give up our traditional values for the sake of extra tourism money? Do we want Iowa to become the Mecca for homosexuals this side of the Appalachian Mountains?
That is an amazing comment that I received, and ultimately one that I was, really shocked by, because as a father of a young child, I tried to convey to him that love comes in all forms, and families don't all look the same. And our family certainly looked different than other people's families growing up. And I would hope that that as a parent of young children, that you would convey to them that love is a wonderful thing, no matter who it is with. And you really have an opportunity here to provide a teaching moment for your children. And that not every family is going to look like a traditional male and female and 2 children, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to polls nationwide, the majority of the U.S. population believes in marriage equality. That wasn't the case back when Iowa became the third state in the nation to allow same-sex marriage in 2009.
Right.
And we're coming up on the 6th year anniversary of that decision. Is it astounding to you to see the attitude swing this quickly in favor of same-sex marriage?
It is. I think anybody that is really truthful about the movement, that has watched the movement occur at the breakneck speed that it's occurred, it has to admit that this was moving faster than any of us could even imagine. Even as I wrote the book, I started on the book about 3.5-4 years ago. My co-author Jim Ferguson and I began on the book. We were watching the polls and watching the mood of the public change. At the time, Iowa was considering the constitutional amendment. More than 62% of Iowans and more than 60% of Americans opposed gay marriage. And so we really believed we were in a real uphill fight. And we had come off of more than 30 challenges at the ballot and lost. And so we really believed that we were having watched Prop 8 go down, and we really believed that we were on a losing ship, and to watch the mood turn and move towards equality was a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Prop 8, which refers to California, sort of if California, one of the most progressive states in the union, can't do it, make this step, then how could Iowa? I guess the thinking was at that time, huh?
And it was absolutely devastating to people in the GLBT movement that were working towards equality and full equality in marriage. And I think that you just can't underestimate the importance of both Judge Hansen's decision August 30th, 2007 in Polk County District Court, which stated that, you know, he saw no purpose to continue this ban on same-sex marriage, and that, you know, it denied people due process and equal protection. And then the historic and unanimous decision of the Iowa Supreme Court, April 3rd, 2009. So watching this, you know, move through district court and then to the Supreme Court, and then, you know, 2009 seems just like a blink of an eye, but today, where the public has moved on this issue, it has been a rapid movement. But I would also say that Lambda Legal, which obviously defended these families that brought the six families that brought the case forward, Lambda Legal really used Iowa as their model for how they were going to pursue action through the courts, and Iowa became a very unique place for that reason. And one of the reasons they chose Iowa was because we had a system of fairness in our courts. Our judges were not elected, and then in addition to that, we had a lot of progressive years where these judges and Supreme Court judges were appointed by both Vilsack and Culver.
My guest is State Senator Matt McCoy, live this first half hour. He's written a book. It's titled McCoy, You're Going Straight to Hell, Heartfelt Letters to a Gay State Senator on Marriage Equality. In it, he tells his personal story of coming out privately, also as a public official, relays the stories, the views of those impacted by laws preventing same-sex marriage, also tells the stories of those or the contacts that he had, the emails, the letters from those who don't agree or didn't agree with a same-sex marriage. I wanted to read one of these, too. Here's one from your book, from an anonymous writer that you received. I don't want to revert to the Dark Ages, and although I don't believe that homosexual people should be classified as special or protected class of people, I am not a homophobe. I simply do not believe that changing the definition of marriage benefits society. How did you respond to such an email?
Well, I mean, ultimately, there's an education process here. There's more than, at the time, there was more than 1,100 federal rights that were not allowed to be bestowed on couples that had been together a lifetime. And these rights really did impact due process and equal protection under the law. And so I felt like, from an education standpoint, I needed to say to people that wanted to point out, well, I don't have any problems with civil unions, but don't call it a marriage. Well, you know, we either have civil unions for all or we have marriage for all. We can't have this stair-stepped, you're more married than your neighbors next door, because as the federal government bestows these rights on you through tax code and through other policies, you're denied equal protection and due process under the law. And that's what I tried to convey to people that I thought had an open mind. And most people had really not thought about the fact that, gee, their neighbors next door that pay property taxes and live in the neighborhood with them and, you know, help support the schools and buy cookies from Girl Scouts that knock on the door. These were the same kind of people that were being denied access under the law. And I wanted them to understand just how that was just a miscarriage of justice.
I hope we can talk a little bit about what you put in the preface of the book about your own personal coming out.
Sure.
You write, from the third grade on, you recall being attracted both to men and women, preferably men. You attended a Catholic parochial school. How did you deal with those feelings in elementary school?
I was very scared growing up. I never could understand where they were coming from, and I used to pray that they would go away.
You prayed to God not to be gay?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nearly every day. And you know, I attended parochial schools my entire life and all the way through college, and I just always assumed that this was one of those taboo subjects that I could never talk about. I certainly didn't have information. What information I did get, I primarily got through the public library system, and I would go to public libraries and read about homosexuality and read what it was and try to self-diagnose myself. I had no one to talk to growing up my entire life about this, and I never felt safe with that secret.
You, reading the writings at the time, also at the public library, you must have thought at one point for a while that you had a disorder.
I did. I did believe I had a disorder, and I believed that it was a secret that could never be discovered. And so I committed to making sure that was one of those secrets that I would take to my grave. And as a result, my life broke in so many ways, and I became a person that developed a deep dependency on alcohol, was clinically depressed, was scared of my own shadow in terms of being discovered, and I don't think that I was unique. As I talked to men and women that dealt with this secret growing up, many of us felt the same way. I think my attending Catholic schools and parochial schools closed an outlet that I would have had otherwise, and it was always just assumed that that this was not something we ever discussed. In fact, all of the years that I attended both parochial schools, grade schools, junior highs, and high schools, I can never remember dealing with homosexuality as a topic in school or even hearing anything positive about it.
Mm-hmm. Not only Catholic schools, Dowling Catholic High School there in Des Moines, but also you attended Briarcliff University, a Catholic university.
Yes.
in Sioux City. There you write that there was your that at that time your first same-sex relationship happened. You married later on after graduation at the age of 26, married a woman. Why did you marry? What were your thoughts if you're unsure about your sexuality?
You know, I think that I was in love. I think that people do fall in love, and especially young people, and people that haven't matured. At the time, I was convinced that I was bisexual. I was convinced that I could overcome that. I believed that that it was a cross or a burden that I believed that I could get beyond because of the love I felt for the woman that I was marrying. And so, I think that's pretty natural when I hear other men and women talk about why they married. They fell in love, they married, and then something happens to people between the ages. And I like to remind my son of this, who's my son's 16, that you know, the feelings you have today and the feelings you'll have in your 20s will change, and the feelings you have in, you know, and who you are, who you become between 20 and 30 will change, and who you become between 20 and 35 will change. And so I think that as I talk to men and women that have experienced this, most feel like ultimately at some point in their life they become one with their orientation, and their orientation then takes over and guides them to the direction they were meant to live. And so I always liken it to I was developing when I married, and I was becoming the person that I was going to become when I married. And that doesn't make me a bad person because I married a woman. It makes me a person that was imperfect and was scared of who I was and was afraid of you know, frankly, living a lifestyle that I thought would be a very difficult lifestyle. And so I think that's why people marry.
Mm-hmm. And once you decided to go public with this, your feeling was?
My feeling was that it was the only way I was going to actually get out of this world with my soul. And so I said to myself, look, you know, you're really, you're depressed, you're an alcoholic, you've got to get through this illness, you got to get well, and the only way to get well is to get honest. And that's when I started confronting my orientation, and that's when I started talking about who I was publicly to those closest around me. And obviously I went to my family, I went to my spouse, I went to my parents, and started talking about who I was. And ultimately was able to, because I was an elected official at the time and I was in the state Senate, I began talking to my colleagues privately about it, and the governor, Governor Vilsack at the time, and I received a lot of questions. People asked me, "Are you going to resign?" No, I'm not going to resign. I'm going to become who I was meant to become, and I'm going to stand re-election. And I made that decision because I felt I had something to offer, and I loved what I did.
Let me follow up on what you just said. We've just got a minute or two left. You've been state senator for 22 years. Half of that time, you, 11 years ago, you came out with your homosexuality. What are your further political ambitions? Do you intend to run for Congress?
Well, you know, I have not ruled that out. It's something I'm looking at right now, and we're doing some analysis to try to determine if there's a path. And ultimately, one of the things we've got to determine is just how people are going to feel about electing an openly gay congressman.
Mm-hmm. So you could throw your hat in the ring to challenge David Young in the 3rd District at some point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And this book was an entree to that, and it was my voice, and that's why I decided to be so public about my story and to tell my story in a public way, because I wanted it to be my voice.
Back on the personal front, can you imagine yourself marrying another man at some point?
I hope so. I think that would be a wonderful thing. If I meet the right person, I definitely would be very open to that.
Okay. State Senator Matt McCoy, thank you for spending this half hour with us. Your latest book, your only book, I believe, right, Senator?
Right.
McCoy, You're Going Straight to Hell. That's the title. I'm not saying that to you, Matt McCoy. Heartfelt Letters to a Gay State Senator on Marriage Equality. Senator McCoy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Michelle Bernard. She's founder, president, and CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. She's speaking tonight on the Iowa State University campus about how American women are changing politics. And we'll have a word with her about that and some other things when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Michelle Bernard, founder, president, and CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. She's a frequent political and legal analyst on MSNBC, also a guest commentator on National Public Radio, contributor to the Huffington Post and the Washington Post's She the People, also author of several books, including Moving America Toward Justice and Women's Progress, How Women Are Wealthier, Healthier, and More Independent Than Ever Before. Tonight, Michelle Bernard will speak at Iowa State University as the Spring 2015 Mary Louise Smith Chair in Women and Politics. Her topic, how women, American women, are changing politics. And she joins us this half hour. Michelle Bernard, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much.
I want to reach out to our listeners. We're challenging, Michelle, our listeners in our social media this hour. In 5 words or less, what is the state of gender equity in politics? Send that to our tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. In 5 words or less, your take on the state of gender equity in politics. Give us, in a nutshell, if you could, Michelle, your take on the state of American women in politics today.
I think that the state of American women in politics today is excellent. You know, I am somebody who looks at it as the glass is being half full rather than glass empty, half empty. We continue to make strides in every aspect of American political life, whether it is as elected leaders at local and state levels, whether it is, elected leaders at the federal level, appointed people, as cabinet secretaries, et cetera, to grassroots movements on issues that span everything from education reform to health care to women's rights, to violence against women, to the war on terrorism. Women's voices today are being heard and I think are having a true influence on the way that we run our nation. So things are good. Is there room for improvement? Absolutely. But are things better than ever? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You said excellent was the first word when I asked you. Excellent, the state of American women in politics today. Yet only about 20% of the seats in Congress are held by women. How can you give it an excellent grade when we have seen, let's say, emancipation, the rise of women in so many sectors of life, but it's been very slow in coming to Congress? Iowa, lagging behind in that sector, electing its first member of Congress only this last election.
Yes. Well, there are two ways to look at it. That those numbers are not, could it be better? My answer is yes. But could it be worse? Absolutely. In the area, for example, of racial justice, we have seen the country begin to take many steps backward rather than forward. We're not seeing that. That is not necessarily the case in terms of gender justice and the equality that we see of women getting involved in politics. In a lot of other countries, and I say this as somebody who I self-identify as a feminist and absolutely believe that the country would be better off if we had more women as policymakers. But if you compare us to countries that that have larger numbers of women in office, oftentimes people don't realize that their systems are different than ours because they have a quota system in many countries to help boost those numbers. And I'm not against the quota system, but the reality is we don't have that in the United States. And as we get to a point in time where more and more women are willing to run for office, and it's a dirty business, but as we get to a point in time where more and more women are interested in running for office, I think that we will see more and more women win.
Mm-hmm. To follow up on that, why don't the number of women match the number of men that run for office? It's often very difficult to get women to run for office, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it, particularly from a woman's perspective, you come under scrutiny that no man would ever come under. I frequently say when you see a male running for office, say governor, of any state, you never hear people in the media saying, "Wow, look at that comb over," or look at his belly fat. Go back to 2008, media commentary about Hillary Clinton's dress, Hillary Clinton's cleavage, Hillary Clinton's pantsuits.
What about that same election? John Edwards' hair. I am pretty. That whole viral thing.
Yeah, it didn't hurt him the way that it hurt Hillary Clinton. Comments about Sarah Palin and how she would be, how on earth could she be vice president when she had so many children. You don't hear people ever ask those type of questions about men who are running for office. And it is demeaning. It is demeaning to women, and it sort of changes the frame of reference sometimes that voters have when they decide who they're going to vote for. The good news is that the kind of comments that we saw in 2008 have dissipated greatly, and we are seeing more of an awareness by members of the media and also by women that they can run on the same terms of men and win and govern just as well, if not better.
Mm-hmm. How would our governing, generally speaking, governing by women, how does that, when you have a greater number of women, how does governing change? You said, I'm trying to remember your exact words, but we have a better system, would be better governed with more women in office.
Well, because, conventional wisdom, particularly in Washington where I live, is that if you take a look at the members of Congress who are women in both the House and the Senate, women want to move the ball forward and are much more willing to find areas of common ground to do so, to reach across party lines, to pass, you know, to enact legislation, write legislation, and do everything they can get they can to get it passed, whether they are working with someone from their own political party or not, to sort of put politics as usual behind them and do what is in the best interest of the nation. And, you know, if you look from anywhere else outside of Washington looking in, the way that our government works and has worked recently really makes absolutely no sense, and it is in no way in the best interests of anyone that lives in the United States. But we see female members of Congress willing to work across party lines and move the ball forward, and I think that we can only be enriched as a nation if we continue to see that kind of work.
In 2014, Iowa elected its first female member of Congress, Senator Joni Ernst, now Iowa's freshman senator. I wonder how much have you examined what made her such a successful female candidate?
You know, I think that Joni Ernst was successful because she ran a good campaign. She was genuine. She did not seem afraid by any stretch of the imagination to state her views on various issues. And, you know, Iowans are so famous for wanting to know their candidates. And Joni Ernst, you know, from what I can see to the greatest extent possible, was willing to be an open book with Iowans and explain to them why she would do a good job for their state in the Senate.
Okay, you didn't mention anything about gender. What part, if any, did her gender play in her success?
I don't think it played any role in her success, and I think that that's a wonderful thing. I think when we get to a point in time where we look at people as being the best candidate versus the best female candidate or the best male candidate or the best African American or Latino candidate, that is when we have achieved everything that our founders had hoped for the nation. I think she was the best candidate. And being a woman didn't have any – I don't think people went out and voted for her because she was a woman. I think they voted for her because they liked her and they thought that she would do the best for them in Washington.
The Iowa caucus is less than a year away. Michelle Bernard, you have your eyes on that date, I'm sure, as well as we do here in Iowa. The big question I'd like you to answer, been asked for months, will Hillary Clinton run?
I believe that Hillary Clinton is running. There's always the small chance that she won't, but everything that have seen her do, from her book tour last year to the listening tour that was touted last week that she's getting ready to start, is a strong indication that Hillary Clinton is going to win, and is going to run. And let me say, I actually have been a proponent of saying that if Hillary Clinton actually decides to run, I would like to see her make that announcement from Iowa. I think it would be an amazing thing for the country to witness. She lost Iowa in 2008, and losing Iowa was the beginning of the end of her campaign. And to come back to Iowa, launch a campaign here, and explain to the nation through the eyes of Middle America why she is the best candidate to be the next president of the United States, I think would be fascinating.
Political pundits, people talk about Hillary Clinton fatigue or Clinton fatigue in general. How does she combat that, or does she need to?
You know, it's a double-edged sword. There's Clinton fatigue, there's Bush fatigue, there's, you know, every sort of fatigue on both sides of the aisle. But Hillary Clinton is her own person. She is not her husband. I think what Hillary Clinton it needs to be more concerned with is not so much fatigue of the Clinton name, but giving Americans an understanding of what she stands for and why they should vote for her. How is the nation going to be different if Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States? What are the issues that she stands for? What is most important to her? What is her vision for the future of what our country will look like? We don't have a clear answer from her on that yet. I suspect that part of her listening tour will be to be out front and hear from Americans what they want and what their vision for the future is, and then Hillary Clinton will tell us, tell the public what her plans are.
How lasting is the damage done by the controversy of a couple weeks ago that lingers on till today about her private emails, having an email server in her home as Secretary of State?
I don't think that, you know, I don't personally see that that would be the end of a campaign for Hillary Clinton. It is just another problem for people who are suspicious of anyone with the name Clinton, whether it be because of these emails and the servers or Benghazi or, you know, any of the things that we have heard. Frankly, since her husband first ran for president, this is something that will make the naysayers even more resolute in their beliefs that this is not a, that she is not a good person and that she is not someone that they want running the country. But Hillary Clinton brings out very strong emotions in people. People see, voters seem to either just passionately adore her or passionately dislike her. And so I think, you know, one of the challenges of this listening tour will be to show us truly who she is, so that questions about, for example, Servergate, quote unquote, can be put behind her.
Mm-hmm. How important is it for Hillary Clinton to have a real competitor in the race for the nomination?
Well, you know, my personal belief is that competition everywhere is good. And I think that Hillary Clinton needs a strong person to compete against. Her book tour was flawed. It was ostensibly the beginning of an unofficial campaign. And what we saw was not a Hillary Clinton who was ready for a primetime 2016 presidential challenge. So I think competition is good. I think it's good for her not only as a candidate to make herself the best candidate she can be in 2016, but when you have real debate and real competition, people can come up with ideas that you never thought of on your own that could really make a difference in the lives of millions of Americans. And I think that alone is reason for us to see some real competition, quite frankly, on the Democratic side and the Republican side.
So let's pivot over to the Republican side. More than a dozen hopefuls there. Quite a contrast to the Democratic side. What do you see as interesting, or the matchups when the funnel reduces the numbers here? Who will be left standing, you think?
Most people will not agree with me, but I believe that if Chris Christie decides to run, I think at the very end we will see Chris Christie and Jeb Bush as the final two.
Two moderates, nobody from the libertarian side, nobody from the Christian evangelical side.
I don't see it. I don't think that that is the mood of the nation yet. We're still a long way away from that. But, you know, quite frankly, when you look at the demographics of the country and what the American people are interested in, most people will tell you that they are either center right or center left. They are not. Most Americans are not to the far right or to the far left. And I don't, looking at the numbers right now, I don't see how a libertarian or an evangelical racks up enough electoral votes to get elected.
Mm-hmm. Rand Paul expected to announce his candidacy in the coming weeks and in the coming days, actually, and to speak in Iowa City as part of that. Where do you see the libertarian movement going?
You know, I think Rand Paul has the Rand Paul, I think, is a rising star in the party. And I think that if he is the leader of the libertarian sect of the Republican Party, what we will see in the medium to long term future in our country is a Republican Party that is more moderate and liberal on social issues, and sort of the same thing that we have seen in terms of other issues. Fiscal issues in particular. You know, the thing, Rand Paul reaching out and working with Cory Booker from New Jersey and looking at, you know, sentencing and drug laws and things that are quite frankly appealing to people who are not typically a part of the Republican Party's demographics, I think it's exciting, it's interesting, it shows him as a leader, and I think it would do the Republican Party a world of good, and I think you will see more and more people who will begin to follow in his footsteps.
Michelle Bernard, you're speaking tonight at Iowa State University about how American women are changing politics. I want to use a phrase. I don't think you care for this phrase, women's issues. How do you see them playing out in 2016?
Yeah, my mantra is that all issues are women's issues. There are some issues that are a little bit more female than others, but all issues are women's issues. And I think they're going to play out a little bit differently, frankly, than we saw in 2008 and 2012. I think the days of us hearing about mortgage moms, soccer moms, terrorism moms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are long behind us. And I think that in 2016, we will see people realizing that women should be involved in issues that range from the war in terrorism to issues such as health care. I think male candidates in particular are going to wisen up to the fact that women should not be defined just by their biology, and that we care about education reform and tax reform and Social Security reform and, you know, what's happening in the Middle East. But you will also continue to see people address issues that women find very important, but that men should find important also. This whole issue of sexual assault in the military, for example, that Kristen Gillibrand out of New York has been so incredibly such a hard worker on in moving that issue to the public forefront. It is a quote-unquote women's issue, but it shouldn't be looked at it that way. This is an issue of national security. It is an issue of how we treat members of our military, and no woman should be in a situation where she is serving her country but also is in fear of rape.
A couple minutes left with Michelle Bernard. Women as voters, very quickly. The number of female voters has exceeded the number of male voters in every presidential election since 1964, and women tend to vote for Democrats. Why?
Well, you know, women tend to vote for Democrats, which is what we in politics call a gender gap. But, you know, we see that shrinking. It is very interesting if you dig down in the numbers. For example, you will see that in the last election, Governor Romney actually shrank the gender gap. So more women voted for Romney than they did, for example, for Republican presidents before him. But what we see even deeper that is interesting, and I don't know how the nation grapples with that, is that typically married women with family incomes over a certain level tend to vote Republican. Women who do not necessarily have the safety net that can be provided by being married quite often find more comfort in the Democratic Party. You will see many women who were Republican who end up divorced ending up running voting for Democrats. So it is a matter of messaging on the part of the Republican Party. In what the proper role of government is when people need help.
Okay, about a minute or so left. Michelle, please comment on the controversy over Indiana's religious freedom law, the nationwide backlash from those who perceived it as allowing discrimination against gays and lesbians. Did that backlash surprise you and Governor Pence's reaction?
The backlash did not surprise me. It is what I expected. We have seen the attitudes of Americans all over the country finally begin to change, and for people to finally understand that that no human being should be discriminated against on any basis whatsoever. I was surprised by Governor Pence's reaction, and I think that this is good. This could swing the pendulum against conservatives for a long time to come, because the nation's just not there.
You think people will remember Indiana? I mean, Mike Pence also talked about as a presidential candidate.
Yeah, I think absolutely people will remember Indiana. I think people will remember Indiana, and people will remember North Carolina. They have been two states that have been incredibly on their face discriminatory in their actions against the LGBT community.
Okay, we have to go. It's been wonderful to talk with you. Michelle Bernard, founder, president, CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. You're speaking tonight at Iowa State University. It's a lecture that's open to the public. You are the Spring 2015 Mary Louise Smith Chair in Women and Politics. Your topic tonight, how American women are changing politics. Michelle Bernard, it's been tremendous talking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, it seems the countries in the Middle East are disintegrating as we watch our news. Yemen, the latest to fall apart. Tomorrow, our political analysts, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, give us their thoughts on what's happening. Also, the latest on the nuclear talks with Iran and that backlash over Indiana's religious freedom law. Politics Wednesday tomorrow. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth. Also, thanks to Julia Davis. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.